Something unusual in the fields in Tennessee. Linda Moulton Howe on top of that story, and we'll find out what's going on there on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Linda Moulton Howe with us. Linda, tell me about this one, this crop formation.
First, I think it is so wonderful that the first known crop formation of 2013 anywhere in the world has occurred in Gray, Tennessee.
Super.
Not England, not Germany, but Gray, Tennessee. And it started at 8 o'clock in the morning on Monday, May 13th. It was 18-year-old Tim Blumberg. He went out to the mailbox for his mom to put a letter in there to be picked up. And he was surprised looking out onto this field of grasses of their neighbor that here that was he could see that some of the grass was down. And he knew that the day before, everything was just perfectly normal. So whatever happened, happened during the night. The Blumbergs are neighbors of Connie Osborne. She's 62. She was born in Carter City, Tennessee, only 21 miles from Gray, where she moved in 1979. So she's lived her entire life in that region. Connie works for Host Engineering, where she is a solder tech. She solders printed circuit boards for hard drives. And the lowest part of her farm is an 8.5-acre field that has 8 different species of grasses growing in it. And she does this for another neighbor to harvest his hay for his animals in exchange for his taking care of her property. The hay field is about 20 feet lower than her house and is dotted with these very huge slabs of limestone that are part of the limestone beneath her hay field and the land. And I have this exquisite photograph of one of these big limestone slabs that Roger Sugden took in investigation there at my news website, earthfiles.com. I think all the Coast listeners would love to see the photographs from this particular formation and to see the land itself. This is really, I think, a genuinely mysterious crop formation. And I talked with Connie on May 27th about her coming home from work on that day of May 13th, and that she could see this big downed area in her hayfield, and she wanted to enter and was wondering, well, who in the world would have come and damaged her crop? So she stressed with me that she walked the entire perimeter of her 8.5-acre hayfield looking for car tracks, bicycle tracks, shoe tracks, any tracks, but she found nothing. And then she told me that a series of odd events had begun happening in Gray since the night of May 3rd or 4th, 10 days before this large 208-foot long by 99-foot wide pattern appeared in her grassy field. Four of her friends called to tell her about a strange blue light hovering in the night sky. And then on May 10th, a 50-pound ball of ice fell out of the sky into a field only a mile or so from her hay field, and the source was unknown. And then in the morning of May 13th, the pattern emerged in the tall grasses. And finally, on Saturday, May 25th, her good friend Robin Wheelock had an unusual encounter with glowing orbs inside this very crop formation. So here now, from Gray, Tennessee, we begin with Connie Osborne.
Friends of mine, and it's three different ladies from three different areas, had mentioned they saw the strange blue light. And they said it was the weirdest thing. And it just, like, hovered. It just stayed there. And they watched it for a good while. And they didn't know what it was.
Did they say what color blue?
Just a light blue.
And no sound?
No sound.
That was May 3rd.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell me how the pattern in your hayfield came to be discovered.
Well, May the 13th is on Monday morning, and I get up to go to work, and I looked down there, but it just looked like the wind. I thought, well, maybe the wind had just blown it down. So I went on to work, and the neighbor's son, he was putting a letter in the mailbox, and he noticed it. my next door neighbor, my other neighbor, Wayne, he came out and looked at it too and said, what is the crop circle? I didn't realize till I came home and I can see the field as I'm driving down the road. And I thought, what in the world has been over there in that hayfield? I physically walked down there and could not believe my eyes.
Could you see tracks of any kind, human or other, leading into or out of that pattern?
No, ma'am. I thought the same thing, and I walked. It's about 8.5 acres. I walked the whole property line. I could see my tracks where I walked down to it. There was no tracks anywhere.
It is sitting right there in the middle of the hayfield. There are no tram lines.
No.
And that's 4-foot-high hay grass, right?
Oh, yes. It's up to my waist.
And the pattern is quite intricate.
Yes. One end, it goes counterclockwise, and on the other end is clockwise. And in the circle itself, it's clockwise halfway around and counterclockwise the other way on each circle. In the middle, both of the U-shaped parts, the one from the left is laid down, then the one from the right is laid down over top of the left. It was just weird how it was done.
And if there is no sign of tracks anywhere around the perimeter of this pattern in 4-foot-high hayfield grass, and you are looking at that kind of complex counterclockwise and clockwise pattern, what do you think could have done this?
I have no idea. I would love to find out, but I have no idea. It just appeared unexplained.
Further north in Indiana, Roger Sugden, a professional photographer and artist, is a member of the Independent Crop Circle Researchers Association. ICCRA investigates American crop formations, and he has driven hundreds of miles at his own expense to photograph and study crop patterns that include 3 in Tennessee that have emerged in mid-May since 2007. The first 2 near Madisonville were reported on May 14, 2007, and then 4 years later on May 16, 2011. Now this month, in the early morning of Monday, May 13th, at 1:30 a.m., Roger was outside looking at the night sky, wondering about Madisonville, when 2 circular clouds connected by a cloud line caught his attention. Right then, Roger wondered if that cloud pattern was a signal that a crop circle might be in Madisonville. So he set off on a 600-mile journey out of intuition, got to Madisonville, and learned that also on Monday, May 13th, 2 circles connected by a bar were found in Connie Osborne's hayfield, but not in Madisonville. Roger had to drive another 3.5 hours northeast to Gray, Tennessee, getting there on Tuesday, May 14th. When he got to Connie's hayfield, walked off the 150 feet long by 60 feet wide haygrass pattern and found clockwise and counterclockwise patterns of intricately laid down grasses with no signs of tracks anywhere, Roger knew the trip was worth it. He was inside the beauty of a genuinely mysterious crop formation, so similar to the cloud shape that provoked him to travel to Tennessee.
What struck me was some giant broadleaf plants, sort of like a stem like rhubarb, and they were absolutely untouched. The grass simply went around them, flowed right around them.
We've seen that in England, often going back to the beginning of the 90s, where whatever the energy is that comes down in a field, making the crop formations, if it is a wheat field, the wheat is down or up, but that there can be thistles or broadleaf, as you're describing, that are totally untouched, as if this is molecule-specific energy.
Yeah, that's exactly what it looked like. They're untouched, and I saw multiple sites of that in there, including standing grass where it just flowed right around it, like it was water. Inside the formation, there are different layers, and there's certainly different directions of flow. The northern circle goes counterclockwise, and in the southern larger circle, it goes clockwise. It's just the opposite. Northern one is counterclockwise. Southern one is clockwise on the outer and the interior. And then what's fascinating is the middle part is this large part that connects them, almost at the center. The flow is coming in from the circles, comes in from one circle, stops at the center, and then comes in from the other circle, stops at the center where this solid section is. There's a little square on the inside of the circular flow, and the flow comes down one side, goes across, comes at the other side, makes a nice little square flow, and inside that square, about 6 or 8 feet square, it's a different direction, which is the flow of the outer circle.
Four 90-degree turns in this four-foot-tall grass?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's quite impressive.
This is a formation that, from your experience, could not have been made by humans.
From what I've seen, I don't think it could, just because if someone would come in here and just make this with a board, these giant broadleaf plants would be crushed, absolutely crushed. They're untouched, and I saw multiple sites of that in there, including standing grass, where it just flowed right around it in multiple areas, not just one. There are people that want to do testing on this. I've got soil samples and plant samples that are going to be tested. But from what I've seen, I don't see how anybody could make this.
What is the intelligence behind the creation of crop formations?
Oh, that's a $64,000 question. I think it's unknown, but I believe that our consciousness, we're all connected with everything. And whatever energies there are, whether it comes from ancient mound sites or from our own cells, we're connected with it.
After Rogers spent a couple of days studying the intricate gray Tennessee pattern, he returned to Indiana with samples for ICCRA to test. But unusual energies persisted in Connie Osborne's hayfield. Her good friend, Robin Wheelock, who was born and raised in gray, took some North Carolina researchers into the hay pattern on May 25th. Robin was standing in one of the circles while he videotaped when what happened next still gives Robin goosebumps.
We went down to the crop circle. The guy was filming it on video. There was one area in the crop circle where we could stand and white orbs would come around.
So you mean that with your own eyes?
On the camera. You couldn't see them with the naked eye.
Were they moving in the videotape?
Yes.
And about how big were they in relationship to, say, a ping pong ball?
He said whenever I got out there that there was three of them came, and one was sitting like on top of my head, and then I had one on each shoulder. The one on top of my head was about the same size as my head.
And you saw this with your own eyes on the videotape?
Yes. The one orb that was on top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
Came down and sit over my heart for a little bit, and then it's like it scanned all the way down my body, down all the way to the ground, and then just took off.
And you were not aware of any of that at the time?
Just the chill bumps on my arms.
You were aware of something affecting your skin?
Yeah.
But you didn't know what it was until he notified you to look at the videotape.
After I came back up to the camera, I see it. After the three orbs and me, it's like the camera went dead. There were squiggly lines in it, and the camera went dead, and there was no audio.
So that was 12 days after the pattern was found. Explain again what you were feeling physically.
There was chill bumps, you know, on my arms and my skin. I mean, the hair on my arms was standing up because of the chill bumps.
Did Rick behind the camera say, do you see anything around you?
Yeah, he was asking me that, and I told him, I said, I'm not seeing anything. And he said, well, you've got three orbs on you. And then he started telling me where they were on me, but I already had the chill bumps.
While you were standing there and you were feeling these goosebumps on your arms, he was telling you that you had three glowing orbs around you that you couldn't see, but you were feeling those goosebumps on your arms. Do you remember having thought voices in your mind or images running through your mind or anything that might have been communication from those glowing orbs?
I have a heart problem. okay? I had a leaking valve, and that causes my heart to get out of rhythm. I had gone on Friday and had an echocardiogram done, and then this happened on Saturday where the orb fit on my heart. The thought that was running through my mind is, maybe it's healing my heart,
right?
Or scanning for the problem, or knows that there's a problem. I have a peaceful, calming feeling.
After this glowing orb settled over your heart for a while, did you feel any difference in the way you felt?
Heart-wise, not until the next day. My heart had gone back into rhythm. I felt very drained of energy.
What goes through your mind about what they are?
I really don't know.
Fascinating, Linda.
It is, and I talked with the videographer today, and they are they have a lot, 14 hours of videotape that they took, and they are going to go through the videotape, and this coming week at my news website, earthfiles.com, if all goes well, they hope to send me a couple of the video frames that they will export from their video so that I can put them in this report at earthfiles.com that Robin said she clearly has seen with her own eyes, has seen these lights moving from her head and her shoulders and the one dropping down to her heart, and that we're going to try to show the audience these video frames specifically in relationship to Robin. This kind of healing has been part of the crop formation phenomena now for three decades. There have been many times when somebody who has been ill has gone into a crop formation and feel that they have been either totally healed, or that feel a lot better when they come out of the crop formations. You also hear stories about people feeling like, as she said, their energy is completely drained and they don't feel good. What makes those differences? We don't know, but we're all convinced that we're dealing with energy systems in the crop formations. And along that line, one of the interesting areas of research that's upcoming, in addition to the people studying the grasses, there's a natural spring that runs near Connie's home. And there have been many fossils and ancient implements, such as a stone axe, has been found there that was dated back to what is called the Woodland Period. That goes back to 1000 BC up to about 1500 AD, filling like a 2,500-year period of time. And that parallels with the mysterious Hopewell intelligence that built literally thousands of earth mounds throughout the Midwest with a central focus in Ohio that does extend south into Tennessee. And Gray, Tennessee has a fossil museum that is just chock full of artifacts. And it reminds me in many ways of England, of being there where the crop formations have also been focused on ancient stone circles and mound sites. And they've always provoked the question in all of us who have gone there, is the intelligence, because everyone who has spent time knows there's an intelligence, a profound intelligence that works through mathematical language, it seems, behind the global crop formation phenomena, and is it knowledgeable about our Earth's past and our present and maybe even our future?
And what's the message? That's the big question, too. Linda, we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about the dying honeybees. As we know, even the Russian president said there could be a war over dying honeybees. We'll be back. Well, next hour, we call it Conversations with Linda. That's when we take your phone calls. Also, all whistleblowers urged to call in as well with some tips for Linda. We're going to come back in a moment. We're going to talk about the honeybees. Where are they? We'll be back. Linda, Russian President Putin is the one saying that GMOs, genetically modified foods, might be killing off the honeybees, and he thinks there's going to be a war over that.
Well, actually, according to a lot of the web reports about this meeting between our Secretary of State and Putin, that at the center of it was, and here's one of the quotes, was Putin said that there was, quote, undisputed evidence that a class of neuroactive insecticides chemically related to nicotine, and he's talking about neonicotinoids that I was talking about in 2006,
That's
2007
right.
on colony collapse disorder, are destroying our planet and our planet's bee population, and that he, Putin, is saying that this could lead to a kind of bee apocalypse in which there could be literal war to stop.
To stop it, yeah.
Well, but what does he want to stop? The biogenetic big corporations, Syngenta and Monsanto, that make a lot of these nicotine-based pesticides, and that he apparently was expressing to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry that he's very angry that Obama is protecting those corporations,
right.
which might or might not be true. None of us know. But I think that I am amazed. I was actually surprised to see this make headlines around the web, at least, and that it leads right into what has been transpiring in the United States, which in a basically is protections of corporations that are making these poisons that are killing the honeybees, which are the pollinators for so many of our good foods. It makes no sense. And it was only about 2.5 weeks ago or so in early May that the U.S. Department of Agriculture and apiary scientists and beekeepers, they all confirmed that the deaths and disappearances of honeybees in the United States in the winter of 2012 to 2013 rose again to at least one-third of all honeybee colonies wiped out. Now, beekeepers have insisted that the major culprit behind this persistent decline of honeybees and other pollinators, as apparently Putin is suggesting, are the nicotine-based pesticides known as neonicotinoids. And one of those is clothianidin. And that is so toxic to bees in the most minute amounts. Science and scientists have shown this over and over again. Well, some European countries, such as France and Italy, have banned nicotine-based pesticides, and they report evidence that the honeybees there are returning to being healthy again. But in the United States, the American Bird Conservancy reported also in May that neonicotinoid pesticides are killing birds that are eating the neonicotinoid-covered seeds that are being put out and distributed around the world by Monsanto. Now, beyond the beekeepers' cry that they know that they've lost at least a third of their honeybee colonies just in those few winter months, but they say that the situation is much worse than that one out of three lost during the winter. Over a year's time, they insist that they are still losing up to 80% or more of their colonies, that this is a persistent crisis that threatens the future food supply for Americans who still want to eat apples and almonds and berries that can only be pollinated by bees. And one of those beekeepers is Tom Theobald. He owns the Niwot Honey Farm in Niwot, Colorado. Tom joined the recent Pesticide Action Network of North America's lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States for illegally abusing and misusing conditional registrations that let nicotine-based pesticides and other poisons on the market over the past decade without the necessary scientific research to know really how harmful the poisons are to honeybees. In other words, EPA is using a bureaucratic loophole to get the corporation's products out into the marketplace, and then a decade later, we are dealing with up to 80% of the pollinating honeybees dying and disappearing. So now, from Niwot, Colorado, is Tom Theobald.
And the fact is, we're not losing 30% a year. We're losing 60, 70, or 80% a year through the entire course of the year.
And that it averages out in those winter months at about...
The winter losses may average 30 or 40%, but the losses through the course of the year approach, in some operations, 80% or more.
And the almond industry, for example, in the spring is going to demand that it bring in pollinators from someplace. Are we now at the final junction point where pollinators will be imported from Mexico and wherever they can get them, and it doesn't matter what happens to U.S. beekeepers?
I don't know. Don't know. But what makes you think that we'll be able to bring them in from Mexico or anywhere else? Because these chemicals are being applied worldwide. It's not only happening in America, it's happening in Europe. And despite the lies that are coming from the corporate world, it's happening in Australia. They'll tell you it's not happening in Canada, but it is. These chemicals are the most widely used in history and are having damaging effects on the environment. There was recently a very long study that had been conducted by the American Bird Conservancy, and they're very concerned about the impact of these systemic pesticides on the bird population. Mm-hmm. They're concerned in Canada that the groundwater contamination has eliminated many of the aquatic invertebrates, which are at the base of the food chain for many life forms, including bird life. So this is something that goes far beyond the bees. As important as the bees may be, this is very pervasive. This is an environmental disaster. I think we may be witness to the most massive poisoning of the earth in human history.
Right.
And I think the science supports that if you look at the science honestly. But the EPA would like you to believe, and they've said publicly that they want their decisions to be science driven, but they look to the science not for answers, but for excuses, for a continuation of their inaction.
Mm-hmm.
And the science is overwhelming. Surveys that were done in Saskatchewan in heavy clay soils, they found that the half-life of clothianidin was 19 years. In 19 years, half of it was gone. If you extend that, it means that it will take over a century for the soil to purge itself of that chemical. And remember, tiny amounts can have profound effects.
Mm-hmm.
Europe has been so contaminated that another one of their agencies, DEFRA, tried to conduct an experiment, and they found that their control colonies were as contaminated with clothianidin as their test colonies were. They couldn't find a place in the UK that hadn't been contaminated with the pesticides in question. And that's what we're dealing with. It could take decades for the soils to relieve themselves of these chemicals. It may already be too late. These are crimes against the environment. And they knew going in, they knew 20 years ago what these chemicals were going to do.
The very fact that the EPA, hearing all of these criticisms from honeybee farmers and from others now for nearly a decade, and resisting doing anything to change their policies, and in fact, giving more unconditional registrations for more poisons, if the governing authority is not taking any of this seriously, what is truly the worst case projection, let's say, another decade?
Well, let's assume that we'd lose our pollination services. We're talking about probably 90 commercial crops. We're talking about all the good stuff that needs cross-pollination, all the tasty stuff, the fruits, the berries. The wind-pollinated crops will continue, rice, corn, soybeans, things like that. But the world will be impoverished. We simply can't let that happen. And ultimately, the EPA reports to Congress. And Congress has done virtually nothing. Why isn't Congress getting into the driver's seat here?
And when you get together with some of your colleagues at Beyond Pesticides and many of the other apiary organizations, what do you honestly talk about with each other on that very question? Why, at the higher authorities of agencies in the administration, that there is total disregard for the poisons that are overwhelming the United States farmland?
You know, we're as puzzled as anyone, maybe more puzzled because we know a little bit more. And what really concerns me is these are a limited number of products that we're aware of and familiar with. What's going on with all those that we don't know about? The comparison has been made to AIDS. One of the primary modes of action of these systemic pesticides is they compromise the immune system. They make the insect community vulnerable to a whole host of things that might ordinarily not be a problem. People don't die of AIDS. They die of all those things that AIDS makes them vulnerable to. They die of pneumonia or they die of whatever. It's the same for the honeybee. It's true that there are many things at work here, that the systemics are not the only factor, but they're an underlying factor that creates the conditions where all of these other things can express themselves. Why was it that we didn't have these kinds of problems with nutrition and viruses and pathogens and parasites 20 years ago? They were out there. What's happened in the meantime? Well, these neonicotinoids have come onto the market, and they have saturated literally millions and millions of acres. It may be to the point that it doesn't matter how well we do our job as beekeepers, because we're going to send healthy bees out into an environment that's hostile for life. They simply cannot survive.
With half-lives in the neonicotinoids of 19 or 20 years.
Right.
Recently, heavy use of the herbicide Roundup is linked to health dangers in humans and other animal life.
Yeah, there have been some serious health problems that have begun to emerge as the result of the use of glyphosate. Glyphosate may be having an effect on the bees in that it eliminates many of the flowering plants.
And the MIT study says that, quote, negative impact on the body is insidious and manifests slowly over time as inflammation damages cellular systems throughout the body. We have hit upon something very important that needs to be taken seriously and further investigated. And that is a quote from one of the lead authors on this MIT study, Stephanie Seneff.
Yes, I think we're going to uncover a lot of things that we had hoped we wouldn't find.
That we're drowning in poisons.
Well, there's a strong argument that can be made for that, yes.
And how do we ever put the genie back in the bottle?
I don't think we can completely, but we certainly can't if we don't start making some hard decisions soon.
Looking forward in the next few months to the end of 2013, is there any lawsuit, any other action that beyond pesticides and all of the various environmental groups and you as honeybee keepers are going to try to do?
Well, we filed a lawsuit against the EPA on the 21st of March. It's an administrative lawsuit. It doesn't call for damages, but what it asks is that the court find that the EPA has not been following the law. It's been characterized in the media as we have called for a ban on these insecticides. That's not the thrust of that lawsuit. That lawsuit asks the court to find that the EPA has not followed the law and has abused the category of conditional registration. Now, that may result in the withdrawal of some of these products from the market, but what we're calling for is that the court hold the EPA accountable under the law.
Mm-hmm. And what chance do you think that it will have to succeed?
I think it has a very good chance, but, you know, in order to be a beekeeper or a farmer or a rancher, you have to be fundamentally an optimist. You have to believe that the cavalry is just over the hill. I think that from what I understand of the law and the circumstances and the conduct of the EPA, I think the court has no choice but to find that the EPA has not followed the law.
And if that happens, what's the consequence?
Boy, if that happens, then the EPA is going to have to start following the law. Isn't that a dramatic change?
Well, who's going to make them change?
Many of these chemicals will have to be reviewed immediately. Many of them will be found to be illegally registered and will have to be withdrawn. And then we'll face the question of how do we accomplish that?
Right. Who's going to make EPA do something that they have refused to do now for years?
Well, the courts and Congress, I guess. Ultimately, I think maybe it comes down to the American people. And I have said many times that as beekeepers, we have little power. The only power we have is the power of public opinion. And if the public takes the time to understand what's going on here and speaks out, perhaps we'll see some change.
Maybe.
Well, and George, one of the things that's going on is EPA is ignoring all of these voices that are saying that clothianidin, for example, one of the nicotine-based pesticides, is killing honeybees, is killing birds, is killing all kinds of things out in the environment. And that ignoring is very much behind the reason why this beekeepers and the public interest group sued EPA in March over the clothianidin and the what they're calling the misuse of these conditional registrations, which is sort of like a King's X card. EPA can say to Monsanto or to Dow or to somebody, we'll give you a conditional registration, which means the science hasn't been done, the testing hasn't been done, but you can put it on the market while we do the testing. And to that point, it was a year ago in March of 2012 that the Center for Food Safety and a coalition of beekeepers, the Pesticide Action Network, Beyond Pesticides, they all got together and they filed an emergency petition with the EPA then asking to suspend the use of clothianidin based on the science of how it so easily kills honeybees. But in March of 2013, a year later, EPA has refused, and it is even said that it will not finish any of its reviews on the so-called conditional registrations that it used to get clothianidin out into the supermarkets and markets, as well as some of the other neonicotinoids, until the year 2018, another 3 years. Meanwhile, if we have an 80% or more mortality going on around the year in honeybees, and more pollinators are dying, and birds are dying, and amphibians are dying, and the headlines come at us all the time like a snowstorm, and pesticides and the poisoning of the planet have to have a great deal to do with all of that die-off. What do we as American citizens do when it appears that something like the Environmental Protection Agency is protecting the corporations that make the toxins?
I know. It really is. And are the other kinds of bees dying off too? Yellow jackets, bumblebees? In addition to the honeybees?
I did a report last year about the decimation of bumblebees in some parts of California and other parts of the country, that it's very clear that from honeybees to bumblebees, there's decline. And we know that we have all of the problems with bats, which may or may not be related to the fact that their immune systems are so compromised, all of these creatures. And I thought that Tom made that perfect point 20, 30 years ago, before any nicotine-based pesticide had ever been made or conceived, we did not have all of these wide-ranging problems in honeybees persisting year after year and even now getting worse after 7 years. And that so many of the beekeepers think that the bottom line answer, just like Europe is trying to ban the nicotine-based pesticides, even as some scientists argue, well, it's a panoply of many problems. Well, 20 years ago, honeybees were not dying at 80% of the colonies year after year after year. And so if the honeybee keepers, who are the ones closest to the honeybees and the problem, say it's the nicotine-based pesticides, I think not only Americans should hear that, but Congress should hear that, the EPA should hear that, and as Putin said, we should do something to stop this bee apocalypse because we need the honeybees and the pollinators to keep making this earth rich in biodiversity and the foods that we love, and without them, we're going to be left to the wind-pollinated soybeans.
Well, the whole world needs to find out.